Alan Crane Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240 for Autumn Semester 2022. Today, capital budgeting. The class today will cover material that will not be on the quiz on Wednesday. I've uploaded a practice example for you for the quiz on Wednesday. The quiz itself will look very similar, just different numbers, to that problem that I've uploaded in your resources tab. And of course, you are free to use that Excel spreadsheet. All you really need to do is understand what goes where and replace the numbers in the spreadsheet with the ones in the problem, and you'd have the quiz done that way too. So one way or the other, I'm trying to make it so that you do okay on it. Now on Wednesday, there will be a quiz on Wednesday. Then next week on Wednesday, there will be a really lightweight quiz, something that is easy for you to do well on. So that should sort of counterbalance, so don't panic on this quiz. But try to master it, because if you can understand that problem that I've put up there in ReggieNet, and also get those understand the Excel spreadsheet, you could ace that quiz and it would look like you were a finance genius, even though we all know that I'm not even a finance genius when it comes to calculations sometimes. Okay, here we go. There was something else. The final exam schedule has been posted. Your final is on Monday, 10 to noon. And I'll put that in your on the calendar and ReggieNet too. But start planning early and often for that. And then after this coming week we do the next week we'll do chapter 12, which is free cash flow analysis. And that chapter 12, I believe it is voluntary. I make it so that you don't have to do that homework assignment. If you do it, it will count for blood, of course. But if you don't do it, it won't count. However, there will be problems on the final, but it will be all from my class lecture, what's on the final about that chapter 12 material. So anyway, that's sort of a preview ahead as we look forward to the end of this happy time we've had together as a family or something like that. Let me have a look at the numbers here. Just for a quick overview, the markets, this was a bull day. It wasn't a wow bull day, but it was a strong bullish day that didn't seem to, well, let me put it this way. The Federal Reserve hit twice last week. First, it did the discount rate increase, higher interest rates, hurt the economy. And then it went on, there was a statement by the Fed chairman or one of the governors, something to the effect that, we are in for a longer period of increasing interest rates than some might have imagined. And that, of course, sent the markets into a tailspin again. But notice that they are coming back. It's like there's a resilience. These things are hitting the markets with negative information, but once that negative information has been impounded, this longer-term bullishness just keeps coming back. And that's what I was saying. We are the investors, businesses, they are actually looking at this as a recovery phase. We are in the recovery now. This talk about, well, we're going into a recession. We were in a recession. It was not nearly what I would have thought it was. And now we're beginning to recover. And as more evidence of that, I'm getting more hits from employers looking for internships for the summer. Lots of internships. So that seems to, well, that's pointing to projections by companies of strong business activity clear into the middle of next year. Excuse me. So, take that for what it's worth, too. Now, going on, crude has broken through that 89 on the nick line at the top side, but it's slid back down today. And it's not going crazy, and it probably, from what I'm hearing from the oil traders, it'll settle back into the band sometime next week. But expect a little bit higher gas prices for a little while. It's not going to kill us, but gold and silver kind of didn't. They tried to have a little bit of a rally, but they ended up just kind of sitting flat for the day. Now, here's the interesting thing. Bond yields were up, which means bond prices were down, which means the bond traders were, bond holders were selling bonds. Well, where were they going? They weren't going to metals, they were going to equities. So this is the reverse of a flight to quality. Investors are going for the safer stuff, the bonds, and they're putting it into the equities, the riskier, more speculative investments. More evidence that we are in a bullish phase right now. Just hoping that it stays long enough for me to get out from under my positions. Okay, Tokyo first. Tokyo had some good news at the start. You see that rise in the spark chart? So there was news that punched it up, but there was no more news, good or bad, and so it just floated from there. That's how we see. It's just a physics process. And it will stay in motion unless there's a force acted upon it. So there was a force that was positive that pushed it up. Once that force was over, nothing else was there, so it just floated and it came off at a decent rise for the day, about 1.25%. London, on the other hand, boy, there was something really grouchy. There was at the beginning it started down and then the bulls tried to pull it up. But man, the bears were really in the mood to tear that thing down. They didn't do a horrible, it's less than 0.5%, but still, it was a bearish day in London. But by the time the sun rose here on the East Coast, see, we had some turbulence there at the beginning, but then the rally started and the bulls had pushed. And they got finished by about mid-afternoon, and then the market just floated. So we're definitely in a good place, comparatively speaking, and a lot will depend on how well the Christmas season sales go. So remember, it is your duty to help the economy by buying Christmas presents. I do too. I go to Dollar Tree, 10 bucks, 10 gifts. And you might want to try that yourselves, okay? Maybe not. Now, going on for the day, to our lecture. This is called capital budgeting. Fancy name for whether to accept or reject proposed projects. Now, a decision has been made for a project since the dawn of humans. We've had potential projects. We figured out whether they were go or no go. Early on, that was probably all gut reactions by the seat of the pants. But we know that projects with risk have been taken on when they didn't have to be taken on. There was a decision made to accept this possibility. Even going back to the Neanderthals, we have a good evidence of a hunting weapons making mine on an island in the Aegean Sea. They have to have said, we have to cross water to do this. It's dangerous. We don't know how to do this very well. We have crude ways to get there. And then we get there. What if there are animals that eat us there? What if there are other tribes that could come and kill us there? But they chose to do it. Why? Because there was profit to be made. And it wasn't just monetary profit. This was before money. So this desire goes beyond money, but nowadays we try to liquidate to dollar terms. By the time we get to the Romans, they were using a method that is still used to this day. it was sophisticated, it got institutionalized, shall I say, in the late Middle Ages and through the Renaissance, this method of decision making using numbers. And it is, to this day, it is not a good method. As a matter of fact, it is kind of invalid in a way. But there was a survey taken several years back. There are three methods for decision making for capital budgeting. There is this old method. It's called the payback period method. I'll show it to you. And then there are two modern methods, the net present value method and the internal rate of return method. So the survey said, well, which one of these three methods do you use in your corporation? A plurality, 45% of the corporations said they still use the payback period method that goes back to the Middle Ages. And yet they're still using it to this day. In fact, a while back, I was with a group of Treasury Finance Department officials at a dinner, and they were talking about, they were saying, well, this project is easy. You take this. They were describing the payback period method. And I just, surely you have some undergrads in finance, and you have MBAs, haven't they? And then I realized these are these things that take time to sink in. That's where you come in. You'll come in at junior level where you can't say much, but as time goes on, the influence of your more modern, sophisticated knowledge will start coming to bear. And so we'll see more companies abandoning the payback period method and using one of the two modern methods. Now, those are the net present value method and the internal rate of return method. One of them is superior to the other. The net present value method is superior to the internal rate of return method. But interestingly enough, in this survey, the second most used of the three was the internal rate of return method, for heaven's sakes. So there we are. You got a lot of work to do in front of you, and you're going to hear something else today that is for you to move forward in your careers and have your voice in something else that's going to be shown here today that has been showing up as a major problem because of something they didn't do when they were doing their method. But first of all, what we're looking for is a way to say yes or no. Get it down to a binary. It's accept the project that is proposed or reject the project that is proposed. That could be anything from, for heaven's sakes, it could be anything from a factory to a truck fleet to an advertising campaign. They all have this thing. Find a pencil that works. The first one I'll show you is the payback period method. This is the old one. And you can see that it has a comfortable logic to it, as it were. So suppose that we have the period, and we have the free cash flow, the actual money that's generated by it. So we go through this and we'll say, okay, period 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Now, at the beginning, you're going to kick out money. Let's say it's $25,000. Now, in period 1, you're going to pick up a little bit of free cash flow, let's say $5,000. Then as the product gets some brand loyalty, it goes up to, let's say, $12,000. And let's say in period 3, it goes up to $18,000. Period 4, it's beginning to see the end of its days. It comes back down to $8,000. And then at the end, we have selling off the last of the inventory, $3,000. Now here's where the second thing that you carry forward comes in. the thing that is very rarely discussed, and it's not it hasn't been done, salvage value. Now, salvage value can be positive or it can be negative, and you add it on to the last year. Don't put it as another year. It's added on to last year. Let's say for this project, the salvage value is $2,000, positive. Here's what I mean by that. At the end of a project's life, matter of fact, I'll tell you, I may have already told you this, but I'll tell it to you again right now. I have to tell this to someone who's not going to tell anyone about it. This is a secret. You, madam, secret, okay? About 7-8 years ago, I was approached by one of the heavier people here in the College of Business. Asked me, they said, well, you're a professional photographer, aren't you? And I said, yeah. They said, we'd like to get headshots of all of the people who work here in the College of Business, in the State Farm Hall of Business. And could you do that for us? And I said, yeah, I'll have to get, you know, a staging set up and get my lights in and all that and find a room that we can do it in. And they said, oh, no, we've got a room. Okay, I didn't realize. They said, there's a room in the basement. And I was saying, the atrium, that's not a good place, but... Then they said there's a back room, and I did not know about it. It's still there. They're actually about to start converting it. But it's like a big cavernous room, and all that's in there is old used computer equipment and some desks and stuff like that. I mean, these computers are those ones back from ancient times with those ginormous heavy monitors, and they had the drives that were these floppies that you plug in. They had old dial-up modems around, those old ones that dialed in, beep, 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 bong, tee-kong, tee-kong, all that. That was all sitting down, all down there. Whenever they replaced computers, they just took the old ones and they put them down there, all over the place, just lots of them. What could they have done? They could have sold those, salvage. They could have easily. Companies do this all the time. They take old equipment and they just put it in a warehouse somewhere and hope that it rusts into the ground. There's a factory, I'll get to that one in a minute. But companies don't plan to get rid, they don't plan the end game. They plan all the free cash flows, but they don't think about what do we do when the project goes away. And I mean, there's a corporation over in Peoria. They have this room, big room, with all these old computers in them. And they've just put them in there when they upgrade every 4 years. If they were thinking, they could have taken those computers and they could have sold them. Easily, they could have donated them and got a charitable tax deduction to underprivileged schools. Those kids would have died if they could have had even older computers. They would have loved it. But they just put them down there and they just sit there, instead of doing something that could have generated salvage value for the company. Now, this is not always a positive number. Here's the big one that is dominating. It has been for more than a few years now, and it will be in your lifetimes a significant issue. That's environmental remediation. Companies are not planning for that cost of cleaning up the mess that they are leaving behind when they close projects. That could be anything from buildings. Over on GE, there's this derelict factory. It's just sitting there. It is an environmental hazard. Asbestos everywhere. God, there's probably USTs, underground storage tanks, toxic waste. It was not planned to do anything with those when that was the geniuses said, let's build a factory. The same, in other words, there's a liability tail that is not being recognized against the positive free cash flows. There would be projects that would be rejected if that guy there at the end was a negative number. And yet companies don't plan for it. You could even get liability insurance for that exposure tail that you've got out there. They don't think about that. So at the end, when you're at the beginning of the project, there will be people who are there at the end of the project, and it would be great if you had already laid out the roadmap for closing the project down. because then they wouldn't have to panic and scramble to find liability insurance, to find places to get rid of equipment. They would know what had to be done at the beginning instead of waiting to the end of the project. And this is happening all over companies that ran projects, positive NPV, positive internal, great internal rate of return, all this kind of stuff. And the problem was that they did not take into account what could be incredibly negative costs, negative expenditures there at the end of the project's lives. This is true all through many industries that, well, now in retrospect, God, this is expensive. And they could have planned at the beginning. And that's where you come in as voices within companies when projects are running, are being decided, being that voice that says, what do we do at the end? What do you mean, what do we do at the end? We have equipment. What are we going to do with it? Well, I don't know, put it in a field, maybe we'll sell it. No, we need a direct, specific plan with numbers on it now. Maybe the numbers are going to be wrong, but at least we're going to give it a stab here at the beginning. That's your voices, the voices that weren't there all through those, all up to recent times. Excuse me. So in other words, you put the salvage value on here at the last year. In this case, it will be the original 3,000, excuse me, plus the 2,000 salvage value. Now here's how the payback period method works. We start out down $25,000. Now, we bring in $5,000, so we're still down, but we're down $20,000 now. We bring in another $12,000, and we're down $8,000. We bring in $18,000, and we're up $10,000. We bring in another $8,000 and we're up $18,000. And then at the end, we're up with that $5,000, we're up $23,000. The payback period method is a policy statement by a company that says we will accept projects only if they pay themselves back in a specific number of years. That could be 10 years, 6 years, 3 years, 2 years. Let's say that the payback period for this company, 3 years. Now, if we look at year three, we're up $10,000, so it's a go. That's all there is to it. And it stopped me. I was at a loss for words when I was hearing them do this orally. They were saying this payback period. They didn't call it that. They just said, well, if you add these up, you find out that in year four, we're positive. And so since we like to see things in 5 years, we're going to go with it. And that was the payback period method. And they were using it in a sophisticated, modern company. Kind of left me speechless, which is uncharacteristic for me. Now, here there are two problems with this. One is a technical problem. Those numbers on the right side, the free cash flow, they cannot be compared to the $25,000 out. You would have to take the present value of them. See that year four, $8,000? That's not worth $8,000 compared to $25,000. It's worth the present value of the $8,000. So they're not taking into account the time value of money. Those free cash flows are decaying as they occur later. So that's a big technical problem, big failure. The other problem is more fundamental. Where do you get the payback period? 3 years. When I was consulting, they had decided on a project using payback period. And I said, well, where did you come up with the 5 years? It was 5 years. Well, I don't know. That's just what we do. In other words, it's arbitrary. There's no technical reason for it. It's just whatever the company feels. And in one case, they couldn't even remember when they started using that number of years. They just said, well, we've always done it with 6 years or whatever it was, and that's what we're going to do. It's the right way to do it, because that's been the way we've always done it. Okay. The arbitrariness of it is its most fundamental flaw. It doesn't have a scientific backing. It does not have any mathematics to it at all. In other words, it's pre-engineering. And in our world, everything has to be dead on precise these days. So there's its greatest flaw right there. But it is still used quite a bit. And it will take another generation, yours, and the one just before yours that I taught 5 to 10 years ago, in order to slowly seep in the better, more scientific methods into this decision-making calculus. Okay, enough of that. That is the payback period method. There it is. Okay, so I'm going to take that off the board here. I'll use the same free cash flow to show you the other two methods. The first of them, the technically more accurate, proper method, is called net present value. Now, I can do this by the formula method that's in your book, or I could do it, and it would take you maybe about 4 or 5 minutes to do one problem, and you'd be possibly making arithmetic mistakes. Or I can show you how to do it on the calculator, and it will take about 20 to 30 seconds. And so I'll let you decide right now which way you want to do it. Do you want to do it the hard way or the calculator way? It's your choice. Which way? Calculator? Fine. Whatever. I'll show you the first way to do it, formula way, but then I'll quickly move us over to the calculator way. The first thing you'd have to do, what you're going to do, is you're going to find the present value of each of these free cash flows and add them to the negative at the beginning. And if it's a positive, we say go. If it's a negative, we say no. So in other words, I'm going to take the present value. Now here's where a problem can come in. Most companies are going to discount at the weighted average cost of capital, the WACC. That's very popular. And of course, that's why I bitch about it, because it's kind of like the WACC is kind of like a holy grail in companies. Fortunately, if I'm not mistaken, Standard & Poor's Global Net Advantage gives you the WACC for any public company you request. So know that there is an easier way to do WACC than what we're doing in class. But the weighted average cost of capital, let's say that the weighted average cost of capital for this company is 8.2%. Now here's where a problem occurs. It's very popular to use the WACC. However, the weighted average cost of capital measures the overall risk of the company. A project might be riskier or less risky than the average risk of the company. So in other words, the WACC is not really tailored to looking at specific projects. This project could be really risky, so the WACC would be underestimating the discount rate. Or it could be a very safe project, so the WACC is too high. The risk factor of this project could be lower. Is there a better way? Well, yeah, the usual way we would do it, if you wanted a good discount rate, the best one we could get, you would use the capital asset pricing model, the CAPM. You get the, but you would want to use the beta of the project. The way you would do that is you would find companies that did only this kind of project and get an average of their betas. That would be probably the best way to do it. But using the CAPM, then you would be tailoring the discount rate to the risk of this project instead of just tailoring it to the overall risk of your company. Is that done? Not frequently, but it is out there, and it's becoming a little bit more popular now than it used to be. The WAC is still predominantly the discount rate that is used if you're doing NPV. Now, here's what you're going to do. If you're crazy, you take year five, and you take that 5,000 times 1 plus the WAC, 0.082 did I say, to the negative fifth power, and you add that to the present value of the $8,000 at the discount rate of 0.082, 1 plus 0.082 to the negative fourth. You add to that the present value of the 18,000 times 1 plus 0.082 to the negative third power, plus the 12,000 times 1 plus 0.082 to the negative second power, plus the present value of the $5,000 times 0.182, 1 plus 0.082 to the negative first power, and you subtract off the original $25,000. That is an NPV, and it's a lot like work. Yeah, I swear, I actually did this for years, and every blessed time I did it, I made an arithmetic mistake. I got tired of it. Fortunately, your calculator can do it a lot faster than you could ever do it, and it won't make a mistake. Turn on the calculator, apps, finance, NPV, go down to 7, NPV. And you turn it on. And you come back to the main screen. Now the first thing you're going to do is key in the discount rate, 8.2. Don't put in 0.082. This is an app, so it'll take the interest rate as a percent. Now, as I've said before, with the TI calculators, a comma tells the calculator that you're done with an entry. So I put in a comma. Now you put in the year zero, the negative 25,000. Now again, you're telling the calculator, I'm done, so you put in a comma. Now, after that, you're going to say, open braces, that second parenthesis. This tells the calculator you're about to be putting in the year one and past that free cash flows. If you get an error, it is most likely because you put a parenthesis there. And I am notorious for that. Okay, so now, the calculator is going to keep a count. So the first entry will be the 5,000. That's year one. I'm done with that. You give it a comma. You're saying, all right, here comes the next year. So you're going to put in the 12,000. Whoops. 12,000. Now you're saying, I'm done with it. You put in a comma. Here comes year three, 18,000. You put in a comma. Here comes year four, 8,000. And then you put in a comma and say, here comes your 5, which is 5,000. Now at this point, second close brace. That tells it I'm done with the positive free cash flows. Now you close off the parenthesis that started it up there, and you say enter. $13,289. It's positive, accept the project. That's all there is to it. If it had been negative, you would have said reject it. So it's a positive NPV project at 8.2%. The NPV is $13,289. It's an accept. Now, what happens if someone had said, no, you've got the weighted average cost of capital wrong? Suppose that the weighted average cost of capital, you should have used 13.5%. Oh God, I have to go back and do this again. No, you don't. I can second enter and I'll open it to edit. Now we're going to go back up here and all we're going to do is change that interest rate. Now it's going to overwrite. So when I put in the 13, I put in the 1, and it will overwrite the 8 that was there. I'm going to have to hit second and insert to scooch and get that 3 in there. And then I just overwrite the 5, the 2 with a 5. And now I've got, let's see what happens. It's positive, 8506. But notice what's happening at 13.5. The NPV has fallen to 8506. So we still accept. But what happens if the interest rate had gone to 18.4%. I'll do it again. Let's see what happens. Second, enter, and edit that interest rate up to 18. Overwrite the 3 with an 8, and then scoot over there and overwrite the 5 with a 4. Enter. Damn it! This one is robust. Let's try 22.0%. This is one robust son of a dog. Try 25%. See how the NPV is falling? Second enter. Let's try 25%. Let's try 25.6%. Soy. Well, I haven't had this one. Try 27%, 28%. You see how the NPV is falling? And then it goes negative. What we're seeing is what's called an NPV profile. The NPV profile plots the discount rate against the NPV. The NPV profile looks like this. if there's one change in cash flow, negative to positive, it will be a straight line. There will be some place where it crosses the discount rate axis. It goes from an accept to a reject, from positive NPV to negative NPV. We call that the internal rate of return. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value zero. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value zero. One more time. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value zero. We can use the internal rate of return as a decision-making method. In this case, let's see what the internal rate of return is. You would have to key in all of this information again, but not put in an interest rate, because it will give you an interest rate. Or I could be lazy, second, enter, to bring the numbers back. And then I'm going to go over here to the NPV. I'm going to replace it. Apps, finance. And if you go down here to the eighth choice, IRR, enter. And now you've got to get rid of the discount rate because it's going to give you one. So you take out the interest rate in the comma. And all you do for an internal rate of return is give it the negative and then embraces the positives. And then you hit enter. It looks like it's going to be around 27.5%. 26.5. So the internal rate of return of this project is 26.52%. That would be the discount rate. If I put in any discount rate below 26.52%, the internal rate of return will be positive. If I put in any discount rate above 26.52%, the internal rate of return would be negative. Any discount rate below the IRR makes the project have positive NPV. Any discount rate above the internal rate of return will make the project have a negative NPV. Again, any discount rate below the internal rate of return will make the project's NPV positive. Any discount rate above the internal rate of return will make the NPV negative. One more time. Any discount rate below the internal rate of return will make the project's NPV positive. Any discount rate above the internal rate of return will make the net present value positive. Make it negative, yeah, negative. So if I write that on the board, discount rate less than IRR means the NPV is positive. If the discount rate is greater than the internal rate of return, the NPV will be negative. Any discount rate down here, it's got a positive NPV. Any discount rate up here will have a negative NPV. Now, here's how this is used in practice. I'll show you an example. Suppose that I had a company is looking at four projects considering them. And the internal rates of return have been calculated for each of these projects. Project A, Project B, Project C, Project D. Project A has an internal rate of return of 12.4%. Project B has an internal rate of return of 8.5%. Project C has an internal rate of return of 7.0%. And Project D has an internal rate of return of 15.6%. The company has a policy. It sets a hurdle rate for projects. And let's say that it has set a hurdle rate of 10%. Here's what that means. 15%, and then 16, 17, 18, 19, 20%. Okay. And on the horizontal axis, I'm plotting discount rates, and the vertical axis, NPVs. Now, if a company has, project A has an internal rate of return of 12.4%. I don't know exactly what its NPV profile looks like. I don't know what that graph looks like. But I do know that the project crosses the discount rate axis at 12.4%. So it has to look like this. It has to have a line that goes crosses the x-axis at 12.4%. That's project A. Project B, I don't know what its profile looks like, but I do know that it crosses the x-axis at 8.5%. Project C, again, I don't know what its NPV profile is, but I do know that that line drops down and crosses at 7.0%. And Project D, I know that that one crosses the x-axis at 15%. Now we look at the profile. Where the heck did I put my colored marker? It irritates. There it is. The hurdle rate here is this blue circle, this blue dot, is on 10%. So if I look, for example, let me look at Project B. At 10%, Project B is negative. So that's a no. If I looked at Project A, well, at 10%, that thing is positive. So that's a yes. If I look at Project C, at 10%, that's way down here. That's a no. Project D, out here at 10%, that thing is very positive. So that's a yes. So the hurdle rate method boils down to simply this. If the internal rate of return is below the hurdle rate, you reject. See how the internal rate of return of the C was 7%? It was below the hurdle rate, and so at 10%, this thing was negative. If the internal rate of return is bigger than the hurdle rate, You accept the project. That's all there is to it. That's it. Now, it's, first of all, the problem, this is actually fairly popular, hurdle rate. You just look at the internal rates of return of the different projects that are being proposed, and you take the ones that have an IRR that's bigger than the company's hurdle rate policy. The problem there is that, okay, where did the 10% come from? I asked that once, more than a few years ago. They were talking about they have an internal rate of return, and it was 10%. I said, well, where did you get that 10%? Well, that's what we've always used. In other words, you're using the same hurdle rate regardless of the macroeconomic interest rate environment. Well, yeah, what's wrong with that? Because interest rates are changing, for God's sake. That's a big problem with this kind of decision-making calculus, is that it's again, you've got that arbitrary, pull it out of your butt kind of number. There's another problem with it. There's another problem, but that's a mathematical problem, and I'll point that out in just a minute. It's a big killer for internal rates of return. But there's another kind of subtle problem, too. When a company sets that hurdle rate, what it's essentially saying is, we will take any project that is risky, but we'll reject projects that are perfectly good that don't have as much risk as we want. Do you see how over a period of time, as you see projects that are of low risk and high risk, see how B and C are low risk, A and D are high risk, you're actually reshaping the company with each decision to become riskier. That's maybe not what you want to do. You want to have a balance. You don't want to keep getting riskier and riskier over time by always taking projects that have a higher risk than your policy hurdle rate. You'd like to say, well, we don't want these low-risk projects. Why not? If they are profitable, if they are above the cost of your capital, for God's sake, yeah, take them. But that's not how it works. Now there's another problem. Internal rates of return have a mathematical issue that's involved in it. To tell you about that, I have to take you back to a darkness in your past. It's called algebra. It's polynomials, in fact. You remember polynomials from some place in your ugly history of math. Well, it's something they probably didn't talk too much about, if they mentioned it at all, is what's called the degree of a polynomial. Let me show you. Let's say 3x squared y equals 3x minus 5x squared plus 1. That is a degree 2 polynomial. The highest power of x is 2. I'm getting to a point in finance here. Now, for example, y equals 4 fifths x squared minus 2 thirds x plus 5/8 x cubed minus 1/2. That would be a degree 3 polynomial. If I did y equals negative 5x plus 4, that is a degree 1 polynomial, because the highest power of x is 1 in the polynomial. In fact, y equals, well, let's say 6. That's actually a degree 0 polynomial, because there's an implicit x to the zero power, because x to the zero power is 1. So, in other words, you've been working with numbers since you were in preschool. You were working with polynomials. You were working with degree zero polynomials first. Somewhere along the way, in maybe junior high school or high school, you saw degree ones. Then they brought you to all these other fancy ones. Now, there's something about this. Let me show you an interesting problem. If I were to graph a degree zero polynomial, you might remember that that is graphed as a horizontal line. It never touches the x-axis. A degree one polynomial graphs as an upward sloping or downward sloping line. One root, one crossing. A degree two polynomial will be a parabola. It could miss the axis, it could cross it and touch it, that would be one root, or it could cross it twice, two roots. The most times it can cross the axis is 2. Degree of the polynomial is 2. It can cross no more than 2 times. If I look at a degree 3 polynomial could cross once. It could cross, touch, come back, and come back down twice. Or it can cross 1, 2, 3 times. The most roots it could have is 3, the degree of the polynomial. I don't know if you were ever shown this or not, but it applies to any polynomial of any degree. Now, what does this have to do with what we're doing here? And I erased the example, which is unbelievable for me, but there we are. You notice in that one, that table that I did for that free cash flow, it changed sign once from negative to positive. It's a degree one polynomial. That's why its profile is like that. One crossing of the axis because it had one change of sign, and that makes it a linear. But if it had 2 changes of sign, let's say it was negative at the beginning, positive, positive, all the way, and then there was such a bad salvage value that at the end it was negative, it would cross the axis twice. That thing would actually be, if I did the NPV profile of it, that son of a dog would look like that. It would have 2 internal rates of return. It's a degree 2 polynomial because it changes sign twice, negative to positive, positive to negative. That means that there would be 2 internal rates of return. They mean nothing. If it has 2 internal rates of return, though neither of them has any financial interpretation whatsoever. My God, if you have one where you had, let's say, negative 25,000, then you went 5,000, then you went, let's say, after the first year, you have to put more money into the project, let's say negative 8,000, and then it goes positive 12,000, then positive 10,000, and then finally finishes up with positive 2,000. That would be 1 change, 2 changes, and then 3 changes. So that one, its NPV profile would be this monstrous thing like that. 3 internal rates of return. You could put it into a calculator, you could put it into Excel, and it would give you one of those internal rates of return. Which one would it give you? Well, it'll start somewhere. And if it starts over here, it'll find this one. If it's decided to start over here, it would probably find that one right there. That's the problem. They don't mean anything. So what would you do? You can't use internal rate of return as a decision-making tool if your free cash flow switches sign more than once. There is a way. It's called the modified internal rate of return. And I promise you I will not ask for one of those on a quiz or an exam. it is a pain in the butt in practice. But Excel can do it like a boss. I'll show you in a minute with this one. Here's the idea of how a modified internal rate of return works. What you do is you have two discount rates. You have what's called a financing rate. So in other words, wherever you spend money, let's say it's 6%. The cost of capital is 6%. That would be the rate you would take the present value at the financing rate and pull that one back to the front. Any negatives you would pull to the front and add those to the first negative. But then you would also have a reinvestment rate. What rate you would get if you put money, if you had extra money. Let's say that that for this project is 10%. What you do with the positives is you take those, the future value of all of those, and put them on the end with the last one. So then you have this first number, the present value of the negatives, 0, 0, 0, 0, and then you have the future value of this last number. And then you do a straight internal rate of return. You can imagine what that is like to do that, though, with formulas. Present value plus present value and then the future values and all that. There's, Excel does it very quickly. It has an MIRR function. The TI does not have an MIRR function, not directly anyway. It's kind of a way you can do it, but it's a pain. Let me show you Excel. I'll show you how it works. I'm going to take that free cash flow. Let me close this. I'm going to take the Excel and do it. Okay, I'm going to do period, free cash flow, and then I'm going to put them over here, the financing rate and the reinvestment rate over here. Now, I don't recall. I tried to keep the your homework from having giving you a problem like this, but we'll see. If it doesn't, watch. I'm going to go 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 for the periods. And then I'm going to key in those numbers. What were they? Negative 25,000. And then I had 5,000, 8,000. Oh, negative 8,000. That's right, negative 8,000. Negative 8,000. And then I had the 12,000 and 10,000 and the 2,000 there at the end. Now, here's how it works. The modified internal rate of return. You say equals MIRR, and you open the parentheses. Now, the first thing you do is give it the free cash flows. That's those. Then comma, you give it the financing rate. Whoops, I forgot. Wait, stop. Let me do a financing rate. 6% and 10%. Screwed that up. Okay, so now MIRR equals MIRR, open parenthesis. You give it the array that has the free cash flows, comma, give it the financing rate, comma, give it the reinvestment rate. The MIRR is 2%. We reject the project. Why? Because the overall return to the project is less than the financing rate. I'm not even making what the cost of the money to reinvest it, the cost of the money is. So in other words, if the MIRR is larger than the finance rate, yes. If it's less than the finance rate, no. That's it. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.